Hi, and welcome to episode 9 of the Tiagi Group Training Intelligence Podcast. I'm Matt Richter. Here's part 2 of the 2-part series where Tiagi and our friend Guy Wallace dive deeply into a discussion about their different instructional design approaches. Part 2 picks up right where we left off with part 1. So, without further ado, here we go. Guy, what is the role of the learner, and what is the role of the trainer, and what is the role of the instructional designer in each of your approaches?
The role of the learner is, I like to refer to learners as learner/performers, so that I'm always cognizant of the fact that we're learning things so that we can perform. In an enterprise context, not in a personal context or an educational context, but in an enterprise context, that's why we're delivering this kind of stuff to people, to enable them to perform better. So the learner brings their background into this, and I've got to be, the instructional designer's got to be aware of what's the incoming knowledge and skills and experiences of the learner. Can we safely generalize those, or no, we can't, they're all over the place. And how is our design going to accommodate that kind of differing entry-level skills? What can we do to kind of get everybody up to some certain level and then go from there? Is that necessary? The facilitator for me is, because a lot of my exercises are structured, they're structured learning experiences, so they're there to guide people through the authentic activities. If I'm going to do some paperwork processing, then that's what that exercise is going to be, and you need somebody there to help them when they get stuck. But it's not an instructor per se, and I haven't used the term instructor in any of my materials. It's always a facilitator of a designed learning experience, loosely designed or tightly designed. And so I think that they're important to provide guidance and help to the learner, but the learner's got to go through some struggles. They've got to go through whatever those authentic struggles are, the real world, and maybe you don't start that way. Maybe you start off with something that's easier, and then you move to harder and more difficult, more authentic application exercises. But that's how I kind of see the roles. The designer has got to have that authentic analysis insight, you know, what's real, what's not. If I've got a mixed audience that's coming, I've got to create something that's authentic enough for everybody, or I'm going to have to allow people to create more authentic exercises with what I give them so that they can practice on something that's real for them, which sure. Could be varied or very much the same, you know, depending on what the content is and who the audiences are, et cetera.
Sure. Tiagi?
Okay, yep. Many things are similar to what the guy says. In terms of the learner, they run the asylum, as it were. We have learners part of the time learning, but we also have the learners training each other. And there's a lot of data which says peer teaching, peer tutoring, peer coaching results in increased learning and performance, both for the person who is tutoring and the person who is learning. So we deliberately teach subgroups of learners, two different competencies, performances, and then we say, okay, teach somebody from the other side the skill you have learned. So learners as trainers is one role change. We also have learners as evaluators. So we give people a scoring rubric, and we say, watch this role play, and you score how the salesperson is overcoming the objections from the client. And often we use learners as coaches, for example, to go back to a similar role play. We tell the person, this is the person playing the role of a salesperson. Your job is to keep coaching him. We will have coaching breaks once every 5 minutes. And we have learners as informants. I'm working on a suicide prevention training package for hotline operators. And some of the content is generated by asking the participants, do you know anybody who recently committed suicide among your group of friends and family and things of that nature, and derive from their inputs the content related to how to identify indications of suicide. So our learners have multiple personalities as trainers, evaluators, coaches, and informants. In addition to instructional designers, also at the end of each workshop, we give teams different modules in the workshop and tell them redesign it. In terms of trainers, just like Guy said, we made them into facilitators. The question is, do you want a sage on the stage or do you want to be a guide by the side? Our approach is for our facilitators to be a sage on the side. And so they have to be subject matter experts to some extent. They need to be coaches when they give a task to the group. They should be coaching them, and obviously they got to be facilitators. And another important part is we want our trainers to be designers. We empower them, we authorize them and say, hey, here is the content, here is the activity, run it, but feel free to tweak it, to modify it, to change it. Only request we have is at the end, go to this website, you will see a form, explain your work around arrangement. What changes did you do? So we can use it as formative data and tweak things. And finally, in terms of instructional designers, we tell all of our instructional designers that you are a trainer. If you are going to be having this facilitated by facilitators, you go facilitate it. We don't want to start a caste system where designers are at the higher level of the totem pole and they just do design and they don't contaminate themselves by delivering the course. We tell the designers spend at least half of the time eating your dog food, at least half of the time actually delivering the course so you don't forget the reality. And if you're doing self-instructional packages, then actually take the course repeatedly and see how it feels. So we create a whole culture of multiple personality syndrome.
I like that, Tyagi, and now I realize where I've stolen many of my ideas over the past, because I was thinking about, in 91 I did a labor relations course for one of the Bell operating companies, and we had four roles in the exercises, the employee and their manager, and then a union steward, and then we had an observer. And so we used that observer role so that the learner could observe the dialogue and capture some information about that and then feed that back to the manager. And the union steward also played that role other than being the tough person in the dialogue. But I've liked your idea about, I always have had in the pilot test sessions for courses, instructor-led, I've always had my developers, my designers and developers deliver their lessons so that they would have to face the music and get real about it and appreciate that a little bit better going into the fray like that. And even if it was self-paced, we usually pilot test the self-paced things with real learners, and so I would have them facilitate those kinds of pilot testing sessions so they could get that feedback about their content. Good approaches. I like them.
How do you both evaluate the efficacy of a project?
Okay, let me jump in first, I had the pleasure of learning about evaluation from Tom Gilbert, who says if your training package works perfectly the first time you try it out, throw that out, because it is not a lean kind of an instructional design. I learned from Susan Marker the absolute importance of one-on-one clinical tryouts in contrast to large group tryouts. And I learned similar things from Robert Horn. So my basic approach to identifying the efficacy of the program, number one, I begin by saying anything less than level 4 evaluation is a hypocrisy. If we say we are focused on performance, more importantly, we are focused on return on investment, let us begin with that. So the only way to find the efficacy is to find how much money we save or measure it against business outcomes. And the best approach is we ask the learners, the participants, to keep a log of how they generated new revenue or how they saved money. And, of course, we can triangulate this. We can cross-validate it with other types of information. And, for example, we trained a group of people how to write direct mail advertising copy. And we measured the efficacy by having each participant write a direct mail ad copy for one of the products in this retailer's catalog. And then we mailed that copy to 1,000 randomly selected customers from the company's database. And our efficacy measure is if at least 5 people order the merchandise, you pass. This is your individual evaluation. And if not, you fail. 5, by the way, was the benchmark of what an experienced copywriter is able to get orders. And if it is less than 5 orders, we go back to the training design and say, how can we make it more authentic and start putting new job aids and things of that nature. So we measure the efficacy by measuring using metrics outside the training system and from the receiving system, as it were, Matt.
Great. How about you, Guy?
Yes. Evaluation has always been tricky. Clients either are going to do it or not going to do it. I had a client, Verizon, with them inbound sales organization where they had all the sales metrics, all the business metrics, so they could measure everything. So how the client looked at that afterwards is that we had reduced the costs of training. We'd reduced it by 50%. And the sales abilities, as measured by sales goals achievement, was easily measured by them. And so they could see, you know, the efficacy of the project. And they were also looking at other things like reducing their ongoing life cycle maintenance costs. But because I use this performance model that identifies, you know, what is the output of a set of tasks and what are the measures for those, my clients and I and everybody involved in the project can see with some clarity what the terminal goal is, that performance. And so that gives them the ability to create better level 2 and level 3 measurement mechanisms to see that if there's no business metric that gets down to what our intervention was impacting. Sometimes the metrics include too many other variables, and so you can't tease that out easily, our client, you know, without going through a lot. And most of our clients don't want to do that. They can just see from their clients if the happiness index goes up, that people seem to be better trained, they're quicker to their proficiency goals. A lot of my clients have measured time to proficiency and use this, my methods, as a mechanism to help enable that, and then they would measure that. But in truth, they often don't pay me for doing those kinds of evaluations, and it's unfortunate, but that's the way it goes. And I think that they don't have the hard measures. They have very soft measures. They liked it. Everybody seems to like it. It seems to be working. But unless you're serving a function that's highly measured in the first place, where you can more easily see your impact, most clients just don't have the energy for that.
Well, Guy, let me build on that. Both of you gave fairly concrete, measurable examples. Whether the client was willing to take those measures and look at them was a different thing. But how do you go about measuring things that are more nebulous or more abstract? So, for example, leadership or conflict management or some of the softer skill sets. How do you build evaluation into that?
Well, I think that when you're looking at process and outputs, outcomes, results, you can measure in either of those places the final terminal result or the process that was used to create that end thing, product. So I'm trying. When I think about things that are nebulous, I've been thinking recently about, you know, how do you turn topics into tasks? Clients come to you and they got a topic they want you to develop training on, and I've been trying to think of the various ways that I've used to try to flip that into a task orientation, so that I can measure it. You know, it's because I can measure the behaviors or the cognition, and then the final output is that, you know, is that response to the request for proposal, is that a good one? Yes or no, and why or why not? And what are the criteria for that output? And what are the criteria for the process? And who are the stakeholders that set those criteria? So how do you know a good one from a bad one is what I would ask clients. But you get into something that's nebulous like leadership, and quite frankly, I've been dealing with that for a long, long time, and I'm not sure what that word means, because it has so many meanings that it's become meaningless, at least for me. I understand Sure. The construct of leadership, but I don't understand what people mean exactly when they use that word. So,
Who was the Supreme Court Justice? Was it Powell? You know it when you see it, but otherwise?
Yes. That was pornography. Yeah.
Right. So, Tiagi, how do you handle the nebulous topical areas?
Okay. My first step is to tell client, how will you prove, establish, show that people have become better leaders? If the client has difficulties defining it, I help them. We do the leadership training. I design leadership training for a client. And the various approaches we use is to have an externally validated 360 instrument, which is matched with the leadership training. There are some very objective, valid measures. For example, the Center for Creative Leadership has some, and we use those instruments, and these instruments are correlated with such validity points as how the retention by these people, how inspiring the people, their subordinates find them, how productive is the group. So we convert, like Guy said, topics into tasks. So what are the outcomes? What are the outputs and outcomes of leadership? And we have no difficulty figuring how to measure things. Conflict management, very simple. We keep a track of the number of conflicts that are referred to the HR department and see if there is a decrease. We often have the participants themselves keep a record of how many conflicts arose during the week, and we use various types of time series measures, and we compare the graduates of a workshop from people who are yet to take it, and things like that. And we love dealing with intangible objectives, but first we spend some time talking to the client, offering various operational metrics associated with that, and then agree upon one of those things. And these are areas where I use a focus group of a bunch of decision makers and tell them, after you finish it, we take a lunch break. If we cannot come to consensus, no lunch today type of a thing.
So, soup to nuts. Let's say you have a project. You're hired to design something. You're hired to build it and then transfer it to their internal team to subsequently run. How long does it take for you to begin the project and hand it off?
I'll go first on this. Of course, it depends on the size of what's got to be built, but I built a 3-day labor relations course. This is, again, quite a while ago. And we did it in about 60 days because we met with master performers and we did the development. We did everything in teams. We did analysis in team, design in team, development in team, pilot tested the thing, and then did the revisions, and then it was updated and ready to go for the next delivery, and then into continuous improvement, of course. So 60 to 90 days for something that's 3 or 4 days long. But it can be done much quicker, too. Part of this was my client, and because we have these, we produce analysis data, then we meet with the project steering team to review it to make sure that they're happy with that we got it correct, and we do the same thing with design. So scheduling those meetings often slows a project down, but if the client wanted to get together and just run through this as quickly as possible, you probably could have been done with it in 3 weeks.
Great. Tiagi?
One of my latest insistence to the client is we want to deliver the workshop tomorrow, unless it happens to be a Friday discussion the client calls. And our approach is that give us 24 hours and we will have the content materials identified and we will, except for logistics, we are ready to run the show. We will have a toolkit of various activities. We have clarity on the goal. We have clarity on the business metrics. And let us run it. And this has been our standard mode of operation. And the interesting thing is the prototype package that we offer even while we are creating absolutely produces appropriate performance changes on the learners. So we don't take too much time, and we say we will do the pilot tomorrow, and if the client is happy with the pilot and say that's all we want, it takes just a day. And usually, though, we confirm the series of learning activities that we have chosen. We have identified key parts of the available text material. And very often, if there is no text material or online material available, we have a subject matter expert with whom we collaboratively deliver the content. We tell the subject matter expert, you know what they should do. We know how they should be taught to do it. You are in charge of the what, we are in charge of the how, and let us have some ground rules, guidelines, and so on. So that's the approach we are using, and we do anywhere from 3 to 5 of these types of design while delivering. By that time, we start producing consistent and reliable results, and that's it. We turn it over to the client and say, continue playing with it, and if you want, from time to time, you can share what works, what does not work, and we will give you more ideas on how to change it.
What resistance do you find from your clients, if any?
To some extent, we talked about this already, Matt, when we were talking about what could be the risks, what could be the dangers. The resistance I find from clients is we want content and we want brand new content. That is one approach, one way of resistance. I also have clients who say, I want everything to be documented. I want the objectives. I want specifications and so on, and we don't do that. And we also have resistance from the client that it has to be approved by the steering committee or a bunch of subject matter experts. We have a simple rule which says, you leave us alone, we will produce the performance changes and the business results you want, and we will charge you $2,000 a day. If you want us to work through a committee, we will charge you $7,000 a day. You take the choice. Unfortunately, very often, Matt, clients hire instructional designers not to change performance, but they want a scapegoat. This is something I learned from a smart friend of mine. So that is a danger. One of the resistances, clients want you to do exactly what they tell you, and we want to collaborate with them and produce change and not do what they ask us to do.
How about you, Guy?
I think that's very much the same here. Of course, I come at this from a more structured, more process-oriented, or at least more obvious structured. You have a lot of structure in your approach, but you freewheel a lot with it. But I think that the resistance comes from clients who think they already know what the solution is and don't want to do any analysis to find out what is it. So I think that that's where resistance comes from, because people want to just jump in and start developing content rather than doing any type of analysis and design, which I think in Tiagi's model, you're doing all of that simultaneously, so you're not doing it absence of that. You got design templates in your head that you're bringing into that effort, and a lot of experience. And the group can help you conduct that analysis. But when a client wants you to do it a particular way, their way, then your Tiagi's approach doesn't work very well, and mine doesn't work very well either. Mine relies on the wisdom of the crowd, the hand-picked crowd, for me, it's always been trying to deal with the politics in big organizations, and this was one of the mechanisms I used to do that, to let the client control the input, the reviews, all of that. Many times, my client, the training organization, wasn't in good stead with their internal clients. And this is often a mechanism to let those clients come in and affect this project their way, get it done their way. But it gives a forum to the supply side to bring forth, you know, the instructional realities of what's going to work and what's not going to work and why, in that kind of business, in that kind of decision-making process.
Sure. So a lot of our clients ask us to do a design and then hand it off to them. How do you go about teaching your methodology to others?
Well, some of my clients have just watched me do a project or two or three for them, and then they're off doing it themselves. But I do have workshops, more formal workshops of various lengths. To teach analysis or design, the curriculum architecture design or the ADDIE level design. And that is part of my method. I've always handed off designs to a group of developers where I usually extend the team at that particular point in time and bring more bodies on.
so I can decrease the cycle time. So I can teach people that so they can hand those things off. Analysts can hand off things to designers. Designers can pick it up from there and carry on with the project to the point where they hand their designs off to developers who should be able to pick it up and go with it from there. So because I have all this structure, I already know how many layers of design I'm going to hand off to developers before I even start, because I've got all these templates that I've created over time to, for me, I generate analysis data so that I can process that analysis data into my design so it doesn't get lost somewhere that, hey, this is the output and measures and here's the tasks that we're trying to teach people. I don't want that to get lost somehow between analysis and design. So I've mechanized my whole methodology here so I could take the pieces of analysis data and put them into the design and then hand that off to developers so that they would know I'm doing lesson 11, 10 came before me and 12 come after me, and so where am I in that? What does the learner know at this particular point in time? But that's, again, from my very structured approach to all of this.
Great. Tiagi?
I try and paper how to do instructional design by having them learn how to do training activities and training games and things of that nature. So I have a structured approach. And the way people learn in, if I'm going to leave behind in my client organization capability for doing instructional design, I take a few good people who are not necessarily subject matter experts. Usually I avoid training subject matter experts to become instructional designers because they have lost the beginner's mind. But I just select people who have ability to think on their feet and who are good writers and say, okay, can you help me and use an apprenticeship model, even though I have a lot of structured activities and games and templates and things of that nature. I have them watch what I'm doing so they can do something similar to that, because the explicit knowledge I have documented, but the implicit knowledge, the types of things Guy is talking about, the politics of the situation and things of that nature, is better absorbed by watching people in action and through actual practice and feedback.
Great. Let's dive into our last question before we wrap up.
Hey!
What's the one thing you can take from the other person that you're currently not doing that you will integrate into your own methodology?
That's an interesting question here. I would, because I don't know that I incorporate everything with that I have learned from Tiagi, but I have incorporated many things, and things that we haven't even touched on here today, such as debriefing and how important that is. And I believe that the phrase used to be, all the learning happens in the debriefing. So I think there's room to take and ideas. The collaborative nature, letting, you know, the learners have more control over what they're learning and kind of how they're learning. I know that you said that, you know, you let the subject matter experts determine the what and you'll determine the how, but you give a lot of freedom to the learners and create a very engaging environment for learning. And I think that that's a huge takeaway, and I've always tried to borrow that and use that when I could. I don't have a good real answer for that one. Sorry.
And Matt, it so happens both Guy and I, wow, almost like poetry, both Guy and I come from the same fundamental philosophy and same fundamental instructional design approach. I have become an apostate in some ways, and I no longer worry too much about doing an analysis or focusing on behavioral objectives. And one of the things I learned from Guy is maybe there is a rationale for doing those things and documenting the analysis you've done and spending time with the client to get it approved, specifying objectives and coming up with the local procedure, things of that nature, mainly because apparently you can charge people more by doing those things.
I thought you said 7,000.
17,000.
17,000 a day.
No. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. 7,000 a day, yes, if I do those things.
Good. Well, do you both have any final thoughts as we wrap up?
I'd like to thank you both for the opportunity to conduct this interview, to be a part of this. And I'd like to thank both of you for continuously sharing your insights and your methods with everyone. Thank you for that on behalf of all of us.
Hey, same thing here, Guy, and you don't know how many people have downloaded your 400 odd number of pages and so on. You've been extremely generous sharing your brilliant ideas and the structure, which probably took a huge chunk of your lifetime. And on behalf of the people who downloaded that, and on my own behalf, I appreciate your generosity.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to both of you for the time. And since we're going to split this episode into two, I'm going to end by saying thank you for joining us for episode 9 instead of 8. And tune in a couple weeks for our anniversary, episode 10. Tiagi, do you have any idea what we should do for our anniversary episode?
But first, here is what the introduction to episode 9 should contain. For the first time in the history of human performance technology and instructional design, we have two NSPA honorary life members talking about the topic.
And both of them are still actually alive.
That was always the curse.
Maybe you should add that. That is a wonderful line. I have no clue, Matt, on what the next one could be. Maybe we can talk about applying these approaches to e-learning.
Great. That's a great idea. So that will be our next episode, episode 10, applying what we've learned in 8 and 9 to 10. And I think there's some kid joke there somewhere.
Right.
What is it? Why is 6...
Why is 7 afraid of 8? Oh, no. Why is 6 afraid of 7? Because 7, 8, 9.
Got it. Good.
Exactly.
Good. So thank you, Guy. Thank you, Tiagi. And tune in next time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Guy. Have a wonderful time in North Carolina.
Thank you, Tiagi.
And that brings us to a conclusion of the two-part Guy Wallace-Tiagi discussions. We hope you enjoyed the show. This has been the Tiagi Group Training Intelligence Podcast. Thanks to Guy for joining us. You can find the Tiagi Group Training Intelligence Podcast on iTunes or on our website, tiagi.com. Guy can be found at pursuingperformanceblog.blogspot.com. Don't forget our sister podcast, the Tiagi Group Business Intelligence Podcast. That is also on tiagi.com or on iTunes. Thank you, and tune in soon, someday, for episode 10. Take care.